Buddhist Summer School, Sunday, 24th of August, 1980.
Yamanabo says, yesterday we considered different forms of motivation connected with the sentence which we repeat, Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. And we saw that perhaps the only worthy motivation lies in our awareness of the fact of dukkha as a universal phenomenon. All existence is in the state of suffering because it is far removed from the supreme, the ultimate nirvana itself. And if our concern with going to the Buddha, living the religious life, is with solving this problem of dukkha with that motivation, then perhaps we are on the right lines. Also, we saw that that motivation is one which involves all mankind, and it also involves the whole of the realm of dukkha as such. How significant are the Buddha's words to anyone who asked for ordination and he invited them to join the order. He said, come bhikkhu, well presented or expounded is the Dhamma. Tread the Brahma path for making a complete end of all ill. Now this is so significant. Tread the Brahma path, live the holy life for the complete ending of all ill. Not merely this ill or that ill, my ill or your ill, but of all ill. Make an end of it altogether. So you see the universal nature of this approach and attitude. So there is no room for just a personal motivation. Most people will naturally start with a personal motivation because it's very difficult for a person to jump out of a limited self-conscious sphere into a universal sphere as such. So the motivation changes from the personal state to the impersonal state. And ultimately, it is not so much a case of I am going to the Buddha as my port of destination, but there is a going to the Buddha as the port of destination. And it's a port of destination which is not something which is just an individual desire, but is actually representative of the movement of the totality of life itself. All life is moving to that final consummation. So, one can no longer refrain from going when one sees this implication. Quite naturally and spontaneously, there is a going taking place. That going is not a spatial movement from here to there. It is not a case of here is ill, there is transcendence or enlightenment or whatever you like to say. It is right here and now. The here now is infinite, absolute, total, everywhere, all the time. so that you don't move really from square one at all, but you transform square one out of the state of ill into the state of the truly well. And thus one can appreciate why, in being apparently concerned for yourself and your own welfare, through the transformation of your own consciousness, you transform the consciousness of everyone else, and also you transform the entire situation in which you are placed as such, in time and space. Time and space are transcendent, if one realizes this. And this happens naturally and spontaneously. It becomes part and parcel of your very being and nature, this going to the Buddha. And as we saw yesterday, the Buddha represents the totality. I think it is Huang Po, is it not? Correct me if I am wrong, who identified the Buddha with the absolute mind, with the absolute itself. They are an identity, and there is a profound truth in that, because in final fulfillment, it is the totality, it is the ultimate, the absolute, which manifests itself through you, the finite and the mortal. This is the miracle of our existence, the miracle of our religious living and spiritual fulfillment. We may ask, who is the Buddha? We all think, when we say the Buddha, we think of Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha, the enlightened one, as we say. That is the historical Buddha, true enough. The Buddha was the great teacher of man, of mankind and of devas. He taught all the realms of nature. He was the supreme teacher of his day, and he is regarded as such by all devout Buddhists, the supreme teacher. But does that exhaust the totality of the Buddha as a teacher? The Buddha represents wisdom. He represents love, Mahakaruna and Mahaprajna. He is the embodiment of all this. And he teaches, what he taught was the result of his being such an embodiment. But if we look around us, is there not Buddha nature and pure mind, the Buddha mind, in everything and everyone? Consider very carefully. Buddha nature and the Buddha mind is not exclusive property for anyone, Siddhartha Gautama included. It is something universal. It's inherent in all existence. Transcendence is embodied in existence. And yet, existence is far away from transcendence. And this is the paradox which we have to resolve for ourselves. When we, through our own finite and mortal being, through the purification, the complete purification of that being, enable this universal perfect reality to function freely through us, then that paradox is resolved. That through the finite mortal, the infinite immortal functions freely. So, the Buddha, as teacher, is in everything and everyone. It is we who have to see that. If we look at, especially in a place like this, you look at the trees around you, you see the flowers, the beauty of everything, the clouds, the sunshine, the peace which is around us. If we look at it, Do we not learn from it constantly? And by our learning, are we not true disciples, therefore? The word disciple means a learner, discipulus, the Latin. Well now, if we are learners, and we learn from everything and everyone around us, we confer teacherhood upon everything and everyone. Everything is our teacher. Everyone is our teacher. We have to learn. And in that learning, the Buddha nature, the Buddha mind, the absolute itself, responds to us. And we fall into tune with it. We get into tune with it. And it is particularly so in our relationships with all human beings. If I learn from you, you are also learning from me, whether you know it or not. That is one of the extraordinary things that happens. Because my act of learning, my act of realizing truth to some degree or other, through you, changes you also. There is an interaction between the people concerned. It draws out the Buddha nature in you. And in this way, one treads the path. One is treading the path, therefore, wheresoever one is. And in whatever situation one is. One is treading the path, therefore, constantly. And this path is in and through your own being all the time. And it includes all paths and also is uniquely your own path. One asks the question, is there only one path to follow? There are several paths, and whatever path you take, if it is in the religious sense, in line with the fulfillment of one's individual being, then that is a true path. There is not only one path. There is nothing to prevent a person from experimenting with various paths. The one truth is not exclusive to anybody. All paths, which are true religious paths, lead to the supreme result. One may be called a butterfly because one goes from one path to another. But how lovely is the butterfly? As it flutters by us. Is it not wonderful? The color, the beauty. And so, whatever path you tread, whatever butterfly venture you make, there is loveliness and beauty in it. And because you are capable of accepting the experiment of trying this, that and the other path, you have done something very gracious to that path and to those who are treading that path, that particular path. There is a unification, really. And this is surely something of the marvelous love that is involved in treading the path, as we call it. There is true love in such going on the path of holiness. And there has to be, of course, the appropriate expression of that love. Love is universal, yes, and it has innumerable forms of expression. The forms of expression depend upon the particular relationship between the people involved. Consider, for example, the fact that the expression of love between man and wife is of one sort, between parent and child of another sort, between friend and friend, between teacher and pupil, between the inner spirit in oneself and the supreme spirit, the supreme creative power in the universe. It's of another sort. The expression of it all is appropriate, has to be appropriate to the relationship. But it is love in its reality then, and in its purity. Feeling plays one of the most important parts in our lives, all our feelings. Because our feelings are very great teachers. If we look at them carefully, they reveal to us what we are and how we live. Now when feeling, which includes all, everything and everybody, turns into the consciousness connected with the knowledge of the equality of all beings. That is to say, one realizes that the so-called other person is only another version of oneself. And oneself is another version of that person. There is what is called the sameness of all beings, which is realized in the deeps of consciousness. The sameness, which is the knowledge of equality of all beings, the equalizing wisdom, as it is called in Mahayana, represented by Ratna Sambhava, and this equality is the samatha, this knowledge of the equality is the samatha jnana samprayukta chitta varga. Quite a mouthful, but that's what it is, the knowledge of the equality. It starts with what we commonly call friendship and goodwill and so on for all others. And it's represented in Sanskrit, by Maitri, Metta in the Pali. And it includes, of course, Karuna, compassion, and Mudita, participating in the joys and the sorrows of others. And this participation in consciousness, in full consciousness, is one of the deep expressions of love. So, one gives gifts to those one loves, the appropriate gifts, even one's whole self. Regarding friendship, for example, in the Sigalovada Sutta, the Buddha teaches that a good friend is the friend who is your friend in need, who will advise you wisely even if you don't like his advice, and so forth, and who will even lay down his life for you. 500 years before the birth of Christ, that statement was made. He will lay down his life for you. That is love indeed. It's a very difficult thing. We can talk about it. We can say, oh, wonderful, and so forth. And perhaps millions of times, immature people say, oh, my dear, I'd give my life for you. But supposing the situation actually arose, would he really give his life for you? It's questionable. These are attractive statements, they are attractive ideals, but to fulfill them in the right way needs realization right within one's innermost consciousness. Because it is one's innermost consciousness which determines the whole shape of your life. All your mental states and states of feeling, your words, your actions, all of them are expressions of your innermost consciousness, which remains a mystery. That remains a mystery. The thoughts, the feelings, the moods, the words, the actions, they are all outward expressions of the functioning of this innermost consciousness. The innermost consciousness is the driving power. It is at one with transcendence itself, the primordial creative energy which releases the entire universe into being. So consciousness itself is very, very important. But try to define consciousness, you'll find it practically impossible. It is like the word mind. We use the word mind very easily and constantly. But what do we mean by mind? What is mind? Do we associate the mind with the brain? Scientists and so on, they have associated mind with the activity of the brain. And in the past century, people even said that just as the liver secretes bile, the brain secretes thought, the mind, the mental activity. People mistake their mental activities in terms of feelings and thoughts and ideas and so forth with mind itself. But supposing one realizes that mind, or begins to see clearly that mind is one archetypal form of that primordial creative energy which releases cosmos into being, maintains it, brings it to fulfillment, and then reabsorbs it. It is an archetypal form of the primordial creative power, whatever that is, that remains the unknown and the unknowable. That is why pure mind, the absolute mind, is something which we cannot know here and now in terms of concepts and words. Our brains cannot think. It's achintya, that mind. It's very, very deep. It's a good subject for personal meditation. Meditation, not just musing, not merely brooding upon the word and upon the ideas which get associated with the word, but the real meditation where your brain is quiet. The brain is the disturber of the functioning, the spiritual functioning of the element of pure mind which exists in all of us. If we didn't have that, if we didn't have some element of the Buddha mind within us, there would be no realizing of enlightenment or being able to live as the Lord of compassion and wisdom. It couldn't happen. So regard mind, you may find it helpful, regard mind as that universal archetypal form of the creative energy which releases cosmos into being and maintains it. Now, the Buddha was the embodiment of mind in that sense. Because what we commonly call my mind did not exist in him anymore. He had so cleansed the psyche. It is the psyche which is constituted by all our mental processes as such, our thoughts and feelings and so forth, our desires, our passions and whatnot. That is the psyche. It's the purification of the psyche which is the task of the religious. When the psyche is completely purified, then that pure mind, the perfect mind, this universal archetypal energy functions freely through you. And then you have direct perception. You see the fact as the fact. You don't need any intermediary or anything in between to help you to see the fact. You see it directly as such. And that seeing is of a totally different nature from all our intellectual penetration and the activity of our brains, even if our brains are amongst the finest brains in the world. That is mind, or something like that at least, and may I say, is mind and the functioning of mind. So it is not so much the mind that you have to purify, because that is already pure, it is the perfect thing, it is transcendent and it is universal. But your the psyche is yours, that really represents you. Mind, that universal energy, interacting with body, brings into being the psyche. And the psyche is rooted in the brain and nervous system and in the activity of the ductless glands. That's what makes the different minds, as we roughly call them, between this person and that person and so forth. It's the psyche which is different. The mind is not different. One can never use the term my mind accurately. My psyche, yes, that is mine, just as my ears or my elbows are mine, belonging to this body. So too the psyche. The organism is a psychophysical organism. We use the term nama rupa, and of course in the Buddhist and Hindu scriptures too, we use the term mind both ways. Mind representing the psyche, the individual psyche, the impure thing which has to be purified, and mind representing the supreme creative energy which releases cosmos into being. Now the Buddha was the embodiment of that state through his complete and utter purification. And as such, he represented, therefore, the cosmic order, the eternal order of things which is inherent throughout the cosmos. It is not an imposed law, it is inherent in everything. That is why, particularly, we see this particularly in the case of all living creatures and plants and so forth. We have the power of, the organism has the power of self-healing. That's one of the outstanding characteristics of the living cell. Life has that power of replenishing itself and of healing itself. One other point in this connection with the state of love. One is in love with life in the real sense then, not in the sense in which the Don Juans and so on of the world were in love with life. But in the real sense, one is totally in love with life. And in marriage, for instance, which is perhaps the supreme field for this perfect expression, there is an unreserved giving of one's whole being to the life partner, and this takes place reciprocally. Reciprocally and unconditionally. And in that there is the perfect marriage, the marriage made in heaven, fulfilled on earth, if you like. One can't play about with the laws of life. One has to see what the truth is and live by it. Live responsibly by it. Now, to come back to this point of the Buddha being the embodiment of this eternal order of things. This was first taught, presented in the Rig Veda. That's where you find it spoken about, and it is talked of as Ritta, R-I-T-A. But if you see, visualize it as R with the dot underneath, which makes the R sound re. Ripta is the word from which write, R-I-T-E, and also R-I-G-H-T and so forth is derived. So if you translate sama sati or sama ditthi as right understanding or right mindfulness, you mean by the word right, you mean there that eternal order of things. That is its significance. And the rightness therefore means the perfection of it. Now, the Buddha was this. And you can see at once that as the teacher, therefore, he represented the Dhamma in the complete sense, in his own being. He was the Dhamma. Now we think of the Dhamma as the law or the doctrine, the teachings, the process of living the religious life and so forth. These things are included, true enough. But what is the deep root meaning of the word Dhamma? It's the same as the Sanskrit Dharma, and it is derived from the root dhri, meaning to uphold. What are you going to uphold? The right to rule others, the right to do this, that and the other, all the rights and privileges which the individual demands, quietly forgetting his duties and responsibilities. What is it that one upholds? What are we here to uphold? We are here to uphold that eternal order of things. That eternal order which is inherent in everything and in everyone, and is the power behind the evolution, the development, the perfecting and the fulfillment of everything and everyone. That is Ripta. And that is what one upholds. And whatever upholds that and enables that to function freely and fully throughout life and throughout the world, that is Dharma. Now we can see something quite extraordinary. You know how the Buddha emphasized the importance of the method, the norm, and the order. This is the sort of order, meaning of order, that he was talking of, I think. The order of the whole universe. So to live the religious life, to live the Buddhist life, to go to the Buddha, and also the second statement, Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Receives a tremendous significance, which relates us fully or as completely as possible to the transcendent nature of the living of the religious life. Because as I'm sure all of you, or at least most of you know, the word religion comes from re ligare, the Latin, which means to bind back. To bind back to what? To transcendence itself. This definition was used by many centuries ago by Servius and Lactantius and St. Augustine. Cicero derived the word religion from re legere, which means to gather together. But that both ideas are valid, because as and when you, the individual, through your own purification, realize this oneness with everything. Realize it in inner consciousness, not hold it as a dogma, a doctrine, as a mere set of words or a belief or something like that, but realize it in inner, realizing inner consciousness that we are at one with everyone. Each person is another version of ourselves. When we realize that, you see, then in our own consciousness we are all gathered together, aren't we? We are gathered together and we are rightly related together. If we bear in mind that the underlying power of love which affects this binding together, binding without bondage, therefore a perfect relating is something which is not in ordinary human experience. We are then gathered together in the real sense of the word. So now the Dhamma. The Dhamma is that which upholds the eternal order of things. Dhammam saranam gacchami. I go to the Dhamma. I am going to the Dhamma as a haven, as a port of destination. I prefer not to use the word refuge because of its association with escapism. Refuge, you run away and take refuge. There is no need to run. Where shall we run away? We can't get out of the cosmos. Wherever we go, we are in this same cosmos, any time, at all times, and therefore there is no point in thinking of the escape. And the word escape, which comes in the Buddhist texts in connection with the escape from this, that and the other, I think if we use the word release out of the state of bondage to this, that and the other, then, instead of talking of the escape from ill, the escape from dukkha, if we see it as ceasing to be a producer and a maintainer of dukkha. Who produces dukkha? I do. Who maintains dukkha? I do. It's the individual who is still under the domination of a separative self-consciousness. It's the functioning of his innermost consciousness which is the source from which all this ill comes into being. And that consciousness is just as that consciousness affects all its outward expressions in terms of our mental processes and speech and action and so forth. Our mental activities are deliberate, conscious mental activity, conscious effort to do what is what we see is really the right thing all along the line affects our consciousness and it changes it, and it changes that consciousness. The nature of our consciousness is our peak point, so to say, where transcendence itself touches us and works through us. And so the living of the religious life, the living of the holy life, the brahmacharya as it is called, has profound meaning. It's the binding back, it's the relating back to the primordial creative source out of which we all come. Tomorrow we'll consider some further points in this connection. And with the third statement, Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Thank you.